Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Welcome back to Those Days, a Michinoku Pro retrospective, episode 8, Double Hell Deathmatch. Those Days is brought to you by Open the Voice Gate and the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find Those Days on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed, as well as the Open the Voice Gate feed, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on social media at Open Voice Gate. And if you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site, where you click the red box to sponsor this podcast. And you can accept a one-time or reoccurring donation, no obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, alongside Kate Slow. In case we are entering the end of 1994 in Michinoku Pro, last time on the program, we saw the introduction and somewhat of the first stage of the rise of Kai and Tai, but now we move the calendar into October, November, and December of 1994. And after a long time where they were making their name really well known in the New Japan Pro Wrestling ring, it's time to really talk about some Michinoku Pro as they close out 1994.
I think the period that we're going to cover here, this three-month run, is one of the more esteemed runs this promotion ever had. It's very exciting to be back. I do apologize for the severe delay. Hopefully, we're back on a monthly recording schedule at minimum, as I can speak for you here, Mike, when I say that diving once again into this footage, wrapping my brain around these notes, and just immersing myself in the world of 1994 Michinoku Pro, an absolute delight. And you're right. Last time we spoke, formation of Kai and Tai, what was supposed to be Jushin Thunder Liger's Michinoku Pro debut, Liger gets hurt, they pivot there. And then we also talked about the finals of the New Japan Super Junior Tag League that year, which did astonishingly well at the box office, largely on the back of Great Sasuke.
Yeah, that's right. As we've seen, 1994 now, it reached its close. Sasuke has somehow in 1 year almost climbed every single mountain you think could be possible as a junior heavyweight wrestler, especially considering where he was in 1992 before. Well, before we close out 1994 for Sasuke, he like has one of the big check marks moments of his career, as we will talk about the Eternal Flame show in Iwate from October 30th, 94. And it really feels like we're at this point, or like in this juncture of Michinoku Pro, where everyone is really online. And at least for me, the thing that I was kind of noticing as we will get into the footage as the timeline goes along here, the Michinoku Pro core is such a tight knit kind of grouping of, I mean, it's essentially 12 wrestlers that at the very least, four or five of them have by this point in 1994 started to take the rest of Japan and the wrestling world by storm. And it's just out of this group of a dozen guys. And that's just in 1994.
I think, you know, one of the things that we've done here is draw parallels between Michinoku Pro and Toriumon and then Dragon Gate. And one of the things that I've talked about and will continue to talk about, especially in this episode, is why some people hold Michinoku Pro in the light that they do, while also not being interested in Toriumon or not being interested in Dragon Gate or not being interested in both. And I think what's so interesting about these promotions, and I don't think this could have been done intentionally by either Michinoku Pro or Toriumon, but you think about 1999 Toriumon and 1993 Michinoku Pro and how bare bones they were and how thin the roster was and how, you know, when you look at those cards and what made TV, you're looking for very specific wrestlers and hoping that those wrestlers are against other very specific wrestlers to bring out the best in one another. And then you can sort of accept the undercard for what it is. And in 1994, with Michinoku Pro, based on, I think, one of our great revelations, the consistency of Jinsei Shinzaki, Sasuke doing what is likely the best work of his entire career this year, Kai and Tai, among others, you start to see Yakushiji and guys like Shiryu really take a step up. It mirrors Toriumon in the year 2000 so much, where you not only have the Crazy Max guys, but you get the introduction of M2K, and then you have you have guys like Genki also taking a step up in stature on the roster. And it ultimately, Toriumon in 2000, still a very small roster, but everybody's working with a little bit more confidence. Everybody's working with a little bit more experience, and the promotion begins to feel like a promotion. And I think 1994 Michinoku Pro, based on what they did in their home region, but also what they did throughout the entire country, I think is a very similar thing. I just think it's funny how those worked out.
Yeah, and I think it kind of works out in a very synchronicitous moment, I guess, if I'm making up a word already, but like, we will see in this episode, Michinoku Pro, after a 1994 where they're running in Tokyo, they're running Osaka regularly. We have a little bit here from Nagoya as well for them. And that they close out their show, their year in Tohoku, and with the kind of big show that they end up having with the Eternal Flame show as well, with that, it's kind of in a way, as the promotion is growing and solidifying, and you get to see like the emergences. And I think you bring up someone like Masato Yakushiji, who I feel like becomes like a backbone kind of person on this roster, given what we see he gets involved with throughout the episode. And it feels like, in a way, as we are aggressively getting to the end of 1994 and then moving on to 1995 and onwards, like, it's almost like I feel like this 3-month stretch is almost a redefinition of the thesis of Michinoku Pro in a lot of ways, because I just felt like, as we'll get into the timeline in the shows, I feel like a lot of synchronicity between like shows that we have here on this episode and shows we have kind of covered throughout the series so far, like Mockland. And it's kind of an interesting time for the promotion to close out its 1994.
Let me throw this at you before we jump into the timeline, because I think there's an argument to be made that the foundation of what we now have come to know as the general layout of a Lucha Wrestling promotion is born on 10/30/94, which is the first show that we're going to talk about here, where you have a big spectacle main event, i.e. an Open the Dreamgate Championship match, but also you have Kai and Tai in the flesh, and Kai and Tai would adapt and evolve over time through 1997 when they leave this promotion. And when you look at the gap in time from post Kai and Tai, Michinoku Pro 1997, until Crazy Max comes in 1998, it's a promotion without a soul, and it's a promotion arguably without purpose. And as you go into Toriumon, you have Crazy Max, and then Crazy Max meets M2K, and then they meet the Italian Connection. But everything that we've come to know about modern day Dragon Gate, modern day GLATE, you know, Osaka Pro at its best, is sort of built off the idea of every promotion is going to need a Kai and Tai type group. They're not all, certainly not all as good as Kai and Tai is. Not all of them are as long running as Kai and Tai is, but they all have a Kai and Tai, and the promotion is largely based around that.
Yeah, and I feel like throughout this episode, we will get to see how Kai and Tai even evolves across a 90-day period, because you get some very different style Kai and Tai according to the matchups, and I feel like there is the immediate just analogy there to Torimon, to how Crazy Max changes when M2K comes about. Well, Delphincore now, this is kind of like Delphincore crisis right now, because now they have these three Technicos that whenever they are facing Delphincore, they are absolute monsters, whereas in other matches where they're just taming with Sasuke, they kind of go back into this more Technico kind of situation that you would be used to see out of Sato and Shiryu especially. And I think that's like so interesting that you kind of at this point, like, it's not that we are seeing the thesis of what Lucha Wrestling promotions are in 1994 case, but I feel like we're starting to see certain ideas and concept by this point in Michinoku Pro, which, I mean, still we're talking within 24 months of this promotion being open, that we see now the idea of a unit like Kai and Tai that can move and evolve, where that's not necessarily has been in the been the case, especially with Japanese pro wrestling before that.
Well, less than 24 months in, with a fully formed identity at this point, you know, in a time when a lot of different promotions in Japan had a vastly different identity, something that is greatly missing from, you know, as we record this towards the end of 2025, something that's greatly missing from contemporary Japanese wrestling is that a lot of these promotions all feel the same now. But 94, you're dealing with the remnants of what's left of Shoot Style, the second era of that. You're dealing with WAR. All Japan is drastically different than New Japan. You've got Joshi going strong, and then Michinoku Pro carves out its own niche. And this is very much an episode in which Michinoku Pro is going to carve out their own niche. As we jump into the timeline, Mike, are you ready?
Let's do this.
So first off the bat here, we're going to go to the Observer. This is from November 7th, 1994. We have no footage to review here, but I do want to note this as it comes back to one of our favorite games of, is Great Sasuke ever going to work for a Mexican-based promotion? And the answer here is sort of. As Dave writes on November 7th, 1994, besides doing its first American pay-per-view, AAA has also announced its first Japanese tour from November 16th to November 21st in southern Japan, with some of the top matches announced this past week. The shows are unique because several Japanese stars like Wild Pegasus, Great Sasuke, Shinjiro Otani, and El Samurai are mixed in with the AAA wrestlers. In addition, the babyface and heel roles that the wrestlers used in Mexico were ignored in putting the matches together, so most of the matches, even exclusively with the AAA wrestlers, wouldn't take place as such in Mexico or the United States. Love Machine was taken off the tour because New Japan is actually behind the promotion of these cards, even though they are being promoted as AAA shows rather than New Japan shows. The idea is that New Japan is sending some of its top junior heavyweights like Otani, Hamada, Pegasus, and Black Tiger to AAA, similar to how WAR sending Tenryu to the WWF for the WF tour earlier this year, which we talked about two episodes ago. New Japan wants to push Machine as American Machine, a new masked character, but since he's not well enough established with New Japan, it wouldn't make sense for New Japan to send him to AAA for the tour. I find two of these things to be really interesting here. One, Dave writes this. This is, again, the November 7th, 1994 Observer. Art Barr would pass away November 23rd, so just a mere 2 weeks after this Observer was published is the unfortunate and untimely death of Art Barr. But we have this here with Sasuke showing some level of not only New Japan affiliation again, but AAA affiliation. Some of this stuff made TV. There's an 8-man tag from Hakata Star Lanes that is Hamada, Sasuke, El Samurai, and Otani against Conan, La Parca, Blue Panther, and Psychosis. It's written as Black Panther. That confused me, but it's Blue Panther and Psychosis. That match is really good. That's out there. I would recommend checking that out if you haven't seen it. But Mike, we don't have Sasuke working in Mexico, but we have Sasuke working in a Mexican-based promotion.
that is being run shadowly by the promotion that he has now found newfound star power in.
Naturally.
Yeah, still not going back to Mexico, but, you know, we're really stringing this out to all senses of credulity of him finally working with AAA.
So we continue on. We're going to move back in time to the October 24th, 1994 Observer. I just wanted to mention that AAA thing up top because we're not going to watch any of the matches for it, but I think that's worth noting. 10/24/94 in the Observer, Dave writes that Michinoku Pro started heavily pushing the 10/30 electrified barbed wire match with the Great Sasuke and Atsushi Onito, which is the double hell death match, the title of this episode. And we go back to the book Sasuke Soars that he wrote in 1995. And I have quite a bit of intel on this match from this book, both before and after the match. Of course, the last time that we talked, we reviewed the 9/29/94 Michinoku Pro show. So we only have about a month of time before we get to this 10/30 show. No footage in between. But we do have this from Sasuke Soars, in which he writes, "I think we had gained fairly stable popularity in the metropolitan area. We are a local pro wrestling group rooted in Tohoku. Just like the festivals of Tohoku, the mission of Michinoku Pro is to take root as a culture in the land of Tohoku. I believe that the day when Michinoku Pro will truly be a success will come when it is part of life in Tohoku. In my second year, I participated in many other organizations, including New Japan Pro Wrestling. However, that was not my intention. It is best not to participate in other organizations. If possible, it is ideal to stay in Tohoku. However, unfortunately in Japan, the harsh reality is that if you are not recognized in Tokyo, you will not be recognized in the provinces either. To put it bluntly, I decided that participating in other organizations is for the purpose of promoting Michinoku Pro and sowing seeds. Of course, since we participate, we will do our best as professionals, but our purpose in participating is to promote Michinoku Pro and to sow seeds. The only thing that matters is that I am recognized in Tohoku. The second year was spent sowing the seeds. I wanted to put my finishing touches on the Michinoku Moriaki area. I wanted to have the death match with Onita, my senior in the independent world, if possible. The first time I spoke with Onita was in April of the year that we launched. Onita himself called the agency and said, I want to help you. It was still just after we launched and I didn't know what to do, so I was very encouraged by the call from Onita. I was grateful that he said of me, it's like seeing my old self. The phone call was the start of the exchange between Michinoku Pro and FMW. I would participate as a guest in FMW at Kawasaki Stadium, and conversely, FMW wrestlers would sometimes step into the ring in Michinoku Pro. As we continued to talk, the idea of a death match between the Great Sasuke and Atsushi Onita started to take shape in my mind. To me, Onita is a great senior who I want to emulate both as a wrestler and as a businessman. With only $500, 50,000 yen in his pocket, he has grown FMW into the third largest promotion in Japan. Perhaps the only wrestler who has achieved such a success story are Ricky Dozan and Antonio Inoki. This is not something that an average wrestler can do. For me, who made Michinoku Pro independent, he was a very interesting person in two senses, as a wrestler and as an independent business owner. Actually, when I talked to Onita, he was not the type of person who was calculating or had particularly detailed thoughts. Onita is, so to speak, a typical old wrestler. He's an extraordinary hero, and in a good way, he has a selfish and arrogant personality. He is not someone who can be measured by normal standards. For example, he went all the way to Morioka and Tohoku to do the electric explosive match, which is the best feature of FMW, and I thought his generosity was impressive. If it was an ordinary person, he would say, what an idiot, I can't do that. However, Onita has the capacity to allow that. In that sense, he is an extraordinary person. And then Sasuke goes in to explain that the challenge was made on July 17th. And Mike, that brings us to October 30th, 1994, Michinoku Pro Eternal Flame. Let's start with the main event and work our way backwards on this show, because we just talked so much about Sasuke and Onita. And I think this is perhaps... It, especially in the context of Michinoku Pro, but I'm thinking just in the wider range of Japanese wrestling, this might be the most essential Japanese wrestling match that isn't a great match. I think everybody should watch this, and it's a match that is fine at best.
Yeah, and before we get into the match in deep, I had a little bit of a note about the build to this. So
yeah, please.
So Sasuke talks about when he went to Korakuen Hall on July 17th, that he wanted to do this death match on October 30th. And this shows how much of a kindred spirit and maybe a mentor-mentee kind of relationship this happen, because Case, you know what you get when you have Onita and Sasuke doing this kind of thing at Cork and Hall.
What's that?
You get the cover of Weekly Pro Wrestling for that week. And on the cover, it is, and I have it hanging in my office right now, it is Sasuke bowing and shaking Atsushi Onita's hand and him begging for the match. And the caption on the cover says, Onita says, "Well, the one thing I have to ask of you is, don't forget about Tohoku and don't forget about Marioka. If we do this match, it has to be there." And it just kind of, in a lot of ways, as like the seven episodes, we've kind of had Atsushi Onita as kind of like this ephemeral character that comes in and out of the narrative. He's always there. I mean, FNW at this point, number three promotion in Japan. But like the big thing that was always talked about with Onita is how much he was the master of the media. And you already see his would-be protege in Sasuke capitalizing on that, getting that cover of Weekly Pro Wrestling, and that brings us to Eternal Flame. So you have that show. You have that event happen in Cork and Hall, right, Case? And
yes.
Then what's the best thing you could do as a promoter for this? Well, after having this crazy show, you put it out on commercial tape. And that's where we go to with the Eternal Flame show. Let's talk about this main event. The entire tape is the entire event and how it's edited on this commercial tape is geared towards this main event, with Rite of the Valkyrie starting with Sasuke in his helicopter coming into his entrance to the Owate Industrial Center parking lot, and then Onita in the in his locker room just taping up his hands. And yeah, well, what we get here is something where just putting my cards necessarily on the table, these kinds of death matches are kind of boring to me a little bit, because it's all built around, okay, getting the explosion spots, the barbed wire hits, and everything else is worked around trying to tease and go into it. And I feel like, frankly, Sasuke and Onita could have gotten to the point in half the time of the teases in this. I was begging for the explosions and everything by the time they came.
I think I like it a little bit more than you, even if I largely feel the same way. I mean, that's my big hang up on doing an FMW watch project at some point, is ultimately I understand what made Onita Onita. I find
he's an incredibly fascinating person. Yeah.
If you go back to the Sasuke book, he says, you know, his success can only be compared to Ricky Dozan and Antonio Inoki. And I think that's a fascinating quote, because I don't think I disagree with it. When I started to watch this again, it's not a good match, but it's so captivating. And it's because it's Sasuke epic. at his very peak, but it's Onita in the Onita ballpark.
Right. It's an absolute epic. And I think having everything from the helicopter and the four matches before that happening before sunset, and then they all setting up, and then like you have this whole thing of Sasuke circling the park as they are getting everything together until it's landing time for it. And just from like the way of how they came to the ring, to just the theatrics of it, and finish and everything after the finish, it's absolute spectacle. And I would say like this is a kind of spectacle that if we are looking for those Dragon System parallels here, maybe it's not to this level of extremism, but I mean, you think about the survival cage masks matches, and you could say, and I don't know if I'd fully go along with it, but I think an argument could be made that if you want a through point, it kind of starts at this point to those kinds of matches, just because of the spectacle and the drama of it, more so than the explosions and the spots themselves.
I had not thought about that, but I think I agree with that. I think if there's a through line there, then there's a gaping hole where I tried to sit with Sasuke's entrance on the helicopter, and not the one that begins the commercial tape, but the one that leads directly into the match when they're not playing music and you can hear
him fist pumping into the crowd out of the helicopter as he came in.
Well, just with him on the helicopter, just just having the raw production where you can just hear the blades on the helicopter. And it obviously this is a match that I've seen before. When I wrote the 30th anniversary article for Michinoku Pro for voicesofwrestling.com, which for those that haven't read it, it's there. It's essentially an annotated match guide. I would highly recommend checking that out if you're listening to a podcast like this. But the image that I use in that article is Sasuke and the helicopter. I think it's the defining image of Michinoku Pro. And as we go through years and years more footage, I don't anticipate that changing. I think this is the most Michinoku Pro image that there is. And I was really moved this time around by the rawness of it. And I was trying to think, as you and I on this podcast a lot, you know, especially during our contemporary Dragon Gate episodes, talk about the death of monoculture and how hard it is to make stars and just feeling disconnected from things. And with that, also the specific ailments that Dragon Gate has in 2025 of production not being what it once was, really feeling the effects of a shoestring operation. And I don't think the fix to modern day Japanese wrestling is that everybody enters every building in a helicopter, but there is an inherent coolness to Sasuke in that helicopter that I think you don't need a monoculture for. You don't need wrestling to feel like it did in 1994, but you do need that, and that's missing from the modern day. And I found that Sasuke and the helicopter was just such a moving image.
Yeah, and like thinking about where Sasuke goes after the purview of those days, like after the split, after everything falls apart, and he finds a common partner in Ultimo Dragon and needing to rebuild things. I just kind of think about like putting ourselves in it. Put ourselves in the minds of maybe two people in Tohoku, and how over the last 2 years, you have seen this guy go from being just like a figure that you hear of doing stuff in Tokyo to now basing his wrestling operation to in your home area. And then he's gone to the biggest companies in the biggest buildings and has really put himself out there. And now he's come back home. He's descending on a helicopter. No wonder this guy got put into Tohoku area office. You know, like this was just as much of a almost pseudo campaign event as anything, just him landing. And maybe it is how much I myself and my wife rewatched the show Veep, that I just kind of like the energy of like this. And it's like, no wonder like Great Sasuke ends up the way he does when you have moments like this at Eternal Flame.
I'm glad you said that. I want to mention one more spot in the match, and then I want to go back to Sasuke's book and talk about what he wrote in the fallout of this match. The spot of the match to me, although I do like during the final big explosion when they go to the helicopter camera and you can see everything up in smoke, I think that's a really cool spot. That kind of makes the entire thing worth it. But Sasuke doing the Sasuke special over the barbed wire is just such an incredible moment. I don't think they get the best camera angle of it, which is a little bit of a bummer, but I do think that spot being in this match, in the same way that if you go back a few episodes to the Michinoku Pro FMW joint show in December of 1993, when Shinzaki does the rope walk on the barbed wire ropes, that is such an incredible essential spot that is burned in my brain forever. The Sasuke special over the barbed wire is as good as it gets.
Yeah, it's a real magical moment. I think that the way, before we move on to like the post-match Sasuke caption here, one thing that's like, I think that is so kind of, if you bought this tape and you watch it all the way to the finish, like if you follow Sasuke and like this figure now, the time limit erupts right as Onita gets the pin with the thunder fire powerbomb. Onita in a last gasp pulls Tanabe on top of Sasuke, and then the explosion happens that Case mentions that you get the helicopter shot of, and then you get Onita valiantly trying to get Sasuke back into consciousness, pour about six bottles of water, it felt like, on him, until he's brings his lifeless body out to Jinsei Shinzaki, who has to encounter Onita screaming at him and handing over the body, and they put Sasuke in an ambulance, and the last thing you see is the ambulance pull away. It's really a match aside. it's really like a beautiful, moving kind of scenario and at least wrestling presentation you get throughout the show leading up to kind of Sasuke's sacrifice at the end of the show. Of course, Sasuke's still alive, but the way that they play it up there, I thought that it kind of only increases his legend a little bit to the onlookers even more.
Well, I think that's a perfect transition into what Sasuke wrote about this match. And again, this comes from Sasuke Source, the 1995 book. This is probably the last time that we're going to reference this. And I'm going to read a pretty big passage here, but I had a lot of thoughts coming away from rereading this today. Sasuke writes after the Onita match, "The electric current explosion match against Onita took place in the outdoor parking lot of the Iwate Industrial Culture Center. I learned one thing through this fierce match. It was true that Onita was definitely putting his life on the line. I was able to see the methodology of a professional wrestler the way that it should be. However, the methodology used was truly horrifically cruel. In the first half of the match, I applied a figure four leg lock to Onita. However, Onita's knees were already in such bad condition that it could not bend completely. It was in such bad condition that I thought if I applied it any deeper, it would break and he would never be able to stand again. At that moment, I knew that this man was definitely putting his life on the line." I want to stop there. Mike, this was written in 1995.
Kayfabe, brother.
I see. That's funny. I read it as the opposite. I read that as a shoot and that Onita's knees were this bad in 1994. Imagine what they must be like now.
Oh, I mean, that's entirely... I think both things can be the same here, Kay. It's like, I think Sasuke thought that he was going to cripple Tsuchi Onita, but I also think that that through this book, it almost is, as we're kind of putting the bow on it, it almost in a way is a testimonial to Tsuchi Onita throughout it. So I feel like he's like, yeah, no, I he's the toughest, coolest guy ever. And I thought I could break his leg, but no, I couldn't do that. But this is a man who puts his life on the line. And
Hell yes, indeed. Sasuke would continue. "After this match, I received more fan letters than usual. I had received fan letters in the past that said I was moved by my match against Liger, but the fan letters for this match were a little different. Not only were they moved, but I received many letters that said it changed my outlook on life. A letter I received from a university student read, 'Right now, I'm leading a lazy student life. After watching Sasuke and Onita's match, I realized that I can't continue like this. Seeing Sasuke fighting so hard despite the atomic bombing changed my outlook on life. I will study harder and become a great scholar in the future.' I was happy when I read a letter like this," Sasuke said. "I was really happy. I was so happy that I was able to have a match that touched the outlook on life of a person who was truly glad that he was doing professional wrestling. This may be common in the genres of books and movies, but it is rare in the genre of professional wrestling. It's something you don't know how many times you can do in your lifetime. I think Onita taught me the desperate determination of a professional wrestler and a businessman throughout this match." This is where I think this gets really interesting, and I've got a larger point that I want to make here, but Sasuke pivots to talking from the match itself to talking about Tohoku at large, and I think this stuff's really interesting. Sasuke says, "There is little entertainment in Tohoku. I was stunned by the loneliness. Only people born in Tohoku can understand this, but Tohoku is a place that has nothing to do with, quote, entertainment. My hometown, Morioka, is the second largest city in the six Tohoku prefectures after Sendai, but even so, when it comes to entertainment, the only thing that comes to mind is Panchico parlors. Other than that, the most you can do is drink alcohol and sing karaoke. As for professional sports, which are the center of entertainment in Japan, there is no professional baseball or J-League. In other words, there is nothing. The lack of professional sports means that there is no entertainment or culture to capture the keen interest and curiosity of lively young people and children. When I returned to Morioka from a tour of Mexico, I was shocked by the loneliness of Tohoku. As I mentioned earlier, during my second tour of Mexico, I was racing through very remote rural towns. It was a town as lonely as the countryside of Tohoku, and it was even poorer economically than Tohoku, but still, once every 2 weeks, a Lucha Libre event was held in the town's area. The townsfolk would come with their whole families to watch the match, hoping to see the town's hero. From the elderly to the children, it was a form of entertainment that three generations could enjoy together in a friendly atmosphere. The Mexican countryside was also lonely, but compared to Tohoku, it was much more culturally rich, with regular Lucha Libre events rooted in the local community. This is despite the fact that it was economically poorer. When people talk about the gap between the center and the regions, they often talk about the economic gap and the delegation of administrative authority. But the essential gap that we young people feel is not an economic one, but a gap in culture and entertainment. It means that there is no culture or entertainment that is attractive enough to attract young people. When I was a teenager, I just wanted to go to Tokyo. That's because the only wrestling organization I was aiming for was in Tokyo. From the beginning, I had no choice. Most young people living in Tohoku today may think that they can find anything in Tokyo, just like I did in the past. However, a culture with a strong foundation cannot develop in a comfortable place. I believe that real culture and entertainment cannot be established without overcoming various difficulties. I think, to move away from the book, to come back to me for a second.
Yeah.
I think this passage in this book made me 100% convinced that the great Sasuke belongs in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. I don't think, and this has been my argument about getting him back on the ballot because he was on in 2004 and fell off with under 10% of the vote. I don't think a lot of people have been able to fully contextualize just how revolutionary Michinoku Pro was from a business standpoint, let alone an in-ring standpoint. And he sort of spells it out in these few paragraphs where he is taking a culture that he loved in Japan, a culture that he loved in Mexico, and blending it and then putting it in the most rural, desolate environment. And although its importance and relevancy has changed a lot over the 32 years of its existence, it's still there and it's still going, and he's still the guy most associated with Tohoku Wrestling, with Northeast Wrestling, with Michinoku Pro Wrestling, and I think that is utterly remarkable.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things about this the selection that I find fascinating, not only in a pro wrestling context, but like the cultural criticism context. And it does kind of in some ways reminds me of some like film criticism that I have read in the past in that. But I think when you talk about the like Tohoku and the idea that Sasuke kind of puts forth of, hey, and this is something that in the 30 years since this book's published has only become more and more of an issue of the population immigration towards basically the megalopolises, Tokyo, Osaka, or Nagoya. Like, that's such a big thing. But, and I think that he touches on a lot of like very relatable things. Like, I think about a lot of, I spent a large portion of my life in the Carolinas, and that allowed me to get kind of engrossed in a lot of kind of mid-Atlantic based kind of wrestling, just because that's an area that still kind of to this day will have big JCP tribute shows that will have like 800 people in Spartanburg come out to it. But the thing that kind of resonates to me is that, like, this was an area in the Carolinas that if you went before 1985, basically all you had was either college basketball, Duke or Carolina, and then you would have pro wrestling and soccer racing, and it's like that's what you would have to do to find culture and find entertainment was like that. And I think the fact that Sasuke hits on this and sees the relativity of it throughout the world is really kind of fascinating. And I think that when we talk about Sasuke and his Hall of Fame candidacy, and especially coming out of doing this kind of like documentary style research that we've been able to do with the series, I wonder if the way Dave and maybe the thought around Sasuke is, oh, he was a big star in the 90s that just fell off like that, and that was such a easy argument to just not vote for him for the Hall of Fame, when I've kind of through this series, especially like reading through Sasuke's source case, I feel like that Sasuke has more of an argument not only for like the wrestling in 94 and being one of the three big godfathers of Lucha Rest, but the fact that if you would take the names away from him and take the names away from Tohoku and Michinoku Pro case, I think if you describe what he accomplishes there as a promoter, as a booker, it's very complimentary to like your Sandy Owens and people like that. Like, if you look at it as like a territorial style promoter, I think that that's a way that people have not thought about Sasuke. And I think that through his book, and especially like how he treats Tohoku in the first 2 years of Michinoku Pro, I think that there's a definite conversation to be had about him as a territorial style promoter, because I think that there's something there with it. I mean, this show has kind of a disputed attendance. Is 5667 is the announced one. Dave goes back and says that he thinks it really was probably about 3,500 there, but that would be a major number for a lot of territories in the 80s. And I think that it's just kind of maybe reframing the way that people look at someone like Great Sasuke. And I think hopefully throughout this series, we're able to kind of get a richer, more deep portrait of this individual. And I really am starting to see the territorial links, and especially with the way that he kind of theorizes about wrestling and culture.
I think, you know, Sasuke's in-ring obviously aids in a Hall of Fame conversation, and I would never suggest that he should be looked at as purely a non-wrestler, but I think him as a promoter is the compelling part of it. There's no part of Sasuke that is a Hall of Fame level wrestler. I mean, if you want to look through the history of Major League Baseball MVPs, you could say his 1994 is similar to, you know, as I look at this list here, you know, maybe a 2010 Josh Hamilton year, where for 1 year, that guy is the best player there is. There's a few other really good years there, but for a variety of reasons, that career wasn't what it should have been. And I think if you look at Sasuke from just the in-ring perspective there alone, yeah, that feels like it's the right comp. But I just don't think people realize there wasn't wrestling based outside of Tokyo until 1993, a full 21 years after the start of, you know, contemporary Japanese wrestling as we know it. I just think that's insane, and I don't think he gets the credit for that. And I think this Onita match really puts a lot of that in perspective, where you have a guy that, you know, if you're going to do the Sabu thing and vote for Sabu this year, which I'm still very much on the fence about as the time we're recording this, but if you vote for Sabu, I think Sasuke is a stronger candidate. I think he was a better wrestler. I think he was a better wrestler for longer. And I think he has this whole other promoter side to his career that is utterly fascinating. So, you know, this project, again, just even through where we're at now in the timeline, you know, it's really helped me reevaluate how I think of Jinsei Shinzaki, and more on that in this episode. You know, it's had me fall in love all over again with Super Delphin. But I think just the magnitude and the presence that Sasuke carried with him in 1993 and then in 1994 on just a much bigger scale, I think is something really important to reanalyze and really important to recontextualize.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, like, as at least as of the time of recording this, it's the we're deep in the 2025 Observer ballot season. I just, like, coming out of this, and especially like when you look at least Sasuke's 1994 and his business that he's doing, it's so remarkable to me that maybe voters in the past weren't able to contextualize that. And maybe it is so much like in the heels of the Japanese MMA boom and Pride and all of that. And whereas the wrestling industry was kind of, you had Noah and Dragon Gate, but not a whole lot else was doing super hot those times. But it's all really fascinating, especially someone, and you talk about like the other figures that we come across here. And I think that, like, this episode, by the end of it, I will have fully just gone completely aboard Jinsei Shinzaki as the MVP of this promotion.
Yeah, this guy rocks. I did not expect that. I really actually thought that was going to be a massive hang up and that I wasn't going to enjoy a lot of his work. And it turns out, at least through 1994, this guy's a stellar wrestler.
Yeah, so talking about the rest of this Eternal Flame show. So we talked about the main event. Let's just zoom through the other major singles match on that show. What were your thoughts on the UWA welterweight title match, Super Delphin versus El Pantera? That was the nominal semi-main event here on this show.
Yeah, this rocked. I really, really liked El Pantera in this match. We're going to get, I think, a lot more footage of him coming up here, and I'm quite excited about that because he wrestles a style of Lucha Libre that is going by the wayside. We talk about this sometimes with the Brazos and how that's just a style of wrestling that is gone, and nobody in 2025 is really doing what Brazos would do. And Pantera, it's a different thing entirely. It's very similar. You know, I think Pantera, I think this match, quite honestly, would have fitted in the Toryumon 2000 project in T2P. But Pantera is doing something here that is just way different to look at with 2025 eyes than anything else. You know, even in a different way than the Onita Sasuke match, Pantera jumped out to me. I was like, oh, wow, he's kind of got his own thing going on here. And it meshed perfectly with Delphin. This felt like one of the biggest challenges Delphin has had so far in Michinoku Pro, which I really liked.
Yeah, because you have Delphin, who at this time, and especially by the end of 94, you could kind of feel like, well, it's time to get Delphin face and then go, and Kai and Tai need to take over that kind of position here. So you get that this heel who gets this outsized popular response, and he, as we've talked about Senior Perfecto throughout the show, the best thing about Super Delphin is the absolute confidence that Super Delphin has in Super Delphin. And he has to face El Pantera, who is an evasive luchador who is being able to basically frustrate someone who at this point in the promotion has been completely unflappable. And how does Delphin solve that problem, especially given the idea that the rest of Delphin Corp by this time got pretty much wiped out by Kai and Tai. So he's on his lonesome defending his belt, and he has to kind of be able to get and capitalize the right position. And that's the way he kind of scrapes away, but by the skin of his, neck, basically, in this match. And it's a real fascinating kind of, this entire show, you get so much kind of different things happening on this that it felt like a attraction that after the trios match that was incredible, and then before the pomp and circumstance of the double hell death match, you got to have, oh, what happens when the most self-assured wrestler in our promotion encounters someone who gets under his skin a whole lot. And I felt like that it was really kind of charming in that kind of way, and I'm excited to see more El Pantera as the promotion goes along.
Yeah, it's almost like just a really quality Brave Game match. I really liked what they did here.
And that trios match that I was referring to, Kai and Tai, Sato, Terry Boy, and Shiryu go against Delphin Corp, Grand Nanawa, Jinsei Shinsaki, and Taka Michinoku in an absolute crowd ball brawl mayhem, ending with Sato pinning Nanawa after a top rope senton. Okay, so this is my favorite thing on the show, and I think this might be my favorite thing on the episode. I'm in love with whenever Kai and Tai gets in the ring with Delphin Corp, and Terry Boy decides that he needs to get his pound of flesh back from Jinsei Shinsaki.
Very interesting, because I did not like this on that level. There's a lot of other stuff that we watched on for this episode that I enjoyed more than this, because I found this match... Well, I agree with you that the Terry Boy Shinsaki stuff was really fun, and I like that that's continued to be a through line for, you know, a year and a half this promotion now. I found this to lack that one signature sequence where you can go, okay, they really turned up the volume here. I don't think it had that. I found this match by the end of it to be a little bit long in the tooth, even if I enjoyed Shinsaki on an individual basis, and I enjoyed Taka on an individual basis, and I enjoyed Kai and Tai as a unit. I did not think this was a strong trios match.
I think that maybe in the Lucha Rest sense, the trios match that would come in Nagoya on December 15th that we'll talk about later on was more of a technical proficient match. I just think the whole... I don't know what it kind of is, but you get Kai and Tai doing a flying start, Shiryu's leveling up to a point where he's an absolute menace, and you get a crowd brawl throughout this parking structure or this parking lot that ends up with multiple people on a lighting scaffold and Shinsaki just kind of taking it to all of them. And I don't know what it kind of is about this match that just stuck out to me from that, but I think you had that along with Nanawa inability to kind of get on the same page, setting him up for his ultimate destruction by Kai and Tai. And I just was absolutely charmed by this. Kai and Tai is the most fascinating unit in this promotion, where they just seemingly are very charming technicos until they go up against Dolphin Corps, and especially if Super Dolphin's in the match, and then they want to rip off their heads. And I am enthralled by it at this point.
I very much enjoy that, yes.
We had Hanzo Nakajima versus Nihiro Hoshikawa on this one. This show as one of the two undercard matches from this. Hanzo Nakajima wins with a deadlift Liger Bomb. And dare I say, Hanzo Nakajima is kind of getting his groove back, because Sasuke needs to have a new number two right now.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. I liked Hoshikawa in this too. I thought Hoshikawa did pretty well.
Yes, this was a boring match. I tell you, these guys, these guys have better in though. This was 8 minutes of fucking boring wrestling.
I mean, that's kind of what we ended up with Masato Yakushiji versus Shark Machine. JK, that's Wellington Wilkins Jr. He ripped off immediately, and you had Yakushiji get put through a Wilkins brawl and kept on trying to get up and get the near falls. The crowd's really kind of getting into it. And but Wellington Wilkins Jr. wins after with a dragon suplex after an avalanche brainbuster. Yakushiji was really good, and Wilkins felt like we're at a point where with him that like the one thing he kind of does now is brawl, and you have to kind of work within that. And at least Yakushiji in this, I felt like, played a good sparring dummy for Wilkins.
It's the best use of Wilkins that we've seen so far. I'm not sure that I would qualify that as good, but it's the best use we've seen so far.
I thought Yakushiji moved really well in this one.
Oh, like, yeah. No, I mean, that's why it was the best Wilkins match we've seen, is that he's in the ring with Yakushiji.
Yeah, and that is the Internal Flame Show. Five matches on it, really all about that double death, the double hell death match. Case liked the Super Dolphin versus El Pantera match more than I did, and I liked the Kai and Tai versus Dolphin Core Trios match more than he did. And that was their, I think, if we look attendance-wise, at this point, their new biggest attended show is
It would have to be, yeah.
Yeah, I would say 3,500. It seems realistic when Dave goes back and reassesses it.
Yeah, I have no qualm with that. No, I can't say for sure, but that sounds right to me. So yeah, the last three matches on that show, I would give a watch. You can skip the first two. I don't think you're missing anything there. Dave wrote about the show in the November 7th, 1994 Observer when he writes, "The major indie show of this past week was Michinoku Pro's biggest show to date," so that answers your question, "on 10:30 in Iwate during a sellout of 5,667. He would later debunk that in a later Observer and go back to the number that Mike just said. But he describes Onita versus Sasuke as the match having explosive barbed wire on two sides of the ring and no ropes and nothing on two sides, but landmines were on the floor, hence being billed as a double hell death match. Since Sasuke's gimmick is flying, which was all but eliminated by the rules and concept, the match was only about two stars. Onita won in 14:55, and Sasuke did the stretcher job. After seeing more videos of Sasuke's house shows with Michinoku, the guy is one of the most entertaining workers in the business and goes to incredible lengths to have great matches. He's similar to Sabu in that he's mentally tough but different. Sasuke is grateful but so daredevilish that he still kills himself with ridiculously high risk moves. Sabu is much less graceful and more brutal, both in style and doing damage to himself." A few other housekeeping notes here. Dave writes on 10:31 that Michinoku Pro and Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gumi will have a joint show on 11:15. We'll talk about that here momentarily. And then Dave writes on November 14th, 1994, that Michinoku Pro is running its own tag team tournament, just like they did in 1993, with Hanzo Nakajima teaming with Black Man, Sato teaming with Shiryu, Taka Michinoku teaming with Grand Nanawa, Pantera teaming with Kendo, Super Delphin teaming with Jinsei Shinzaki, and Terry Boy teaming with Mascara Magique. It's top star with the great, and then Dave writes, "It's top star great Sasuke is out of action selling the injuries from an explosive double hell death match with Atsushi Onita that got an incredible amount of media attention. They blew up the ring at the 15-minute mark just after Onita scored the pin. At one point in the match, Sasuke did a tope over the barbed wire but landed way short of Onita and crashed and burned. Judging from the photos," this is where Dave writes, "that it was probably about 3,500 in attendance, not 5,667. So your thoughts there, Mike. We don't have any of this tag league footage, but I should note that Shinzaki and Delphin would win the tag league over Nanawa and Taka Michinoku in the finals.
Yeah. I'm bummed that I haven't been able to hunt this down, because I really, maybe I still have a soft spot for Hanzo Nakajima, but seeing him team with Black Men, if any of that may tape, I'm here for it. I don't know how much I have seen, if any, of Mascara Mahika, to be honest.
He popped up on something I was watching recently. Let me hit him on Cage Match real quick. I'm trying to figure out why I would have just recently watched him, but I don't know when that would have been. As I do a quick YouTube here, nothing is looking as familiar as I was hoping that it would. I'm getting some SB Kento match recommendations that I don't want. Let me hit him on Cage Match real quick and go to the match guide and just see if there's something obvious that I'm forgetting, because I feel like we just talked about him somewhat recently. Now, of course, Eddie Guerrero went under that name momentarily, but that's not who Dave is talking about here. That's 1994 still. That's the tag league at 94. Huh, I don't know. I just watched him in something, and now I can't think of what it was. So forget me. I know what he's in. He's in that April 1997 Cibernetico match that I think DVDVR voted as the best lucha match of the 90s, and he's really good in that match.
Okay, yeah.
I watched that match about 6 months ago. That's what I know him from, and he's very enjoyable there.
Your viewing history memory is miles better than me.
It's not that good, because I had to go to the match guide and then fumble through. Luckily, it's a short list of recommended matches, but I saw that and I knew that was what I saw him from. So there you go. So we don't have any of that tag league footage. I think we start getting tag league footage
in 95, I'm pretty sure.
I was going to say 96. We might not even get any in 95, because 95 is such a weird year in terms of what airs and what doesn't.
That's right. Yeah.
Sadly, no 93 tag league, or at least no major parts of the 93 tag league, and sadly, no 1994 tag league, because that's a very fun lineup that I would have liked to have seen more of.
I'm still going to try to hunt this down and watch it in my spare time, and when I get it, I'll get you apprised of it.
Yeah, there's a Sato and Shiryu versus Kendo and Pantera match that is burning a hole in my eyeballs, let me tell you. That sounds like a very, very fun contest. Anything with Kendo, I think, is worth a watch. Mike, we're going to go to Tokyo. We're leaving the Michinoku Pro home base. We're leaving Michinoku Pro. We're going to Tokyo. We're going to the Tokyo Dome. And we're going to All Japan Women on November 20th, 1994. I think one of the more famous shows in the history of Japanese wrestling. And there is a Michinoku Pro six-man tag team match here, as it is, to my knowledge, the only time we've had a Michinoku Pro six-man in the Dome. It was on the Big Egg Wrestling Universe show, and we can talk about this match now if you would like.
Yeah, and I think that the big thing that kind of struck me in this one is the kind of flexibility of Kai and Tai, and how Sato and Shiryu basically were wrestling more like 1993 Sato and Shiryu, at least in personality wise. This was more of a, I felt like, a Michinoku, what you would consider a Michinoku showcase at this point.
This is like a standard touring match.
Right. Yeah. And I felt like it started off with a lot of Joki Nanawa, but you had the through line of Delphin and Sato, and it did kick off, it kicked into a higher gear with it, but it did kind of, it's a touring match. Sasuke wins with the Thunder Firebomb on Nanawa, adapting that now as a finishing move for him going forward. But it's just neat to see the Dome really react to Nanawa's comedy, at the very least. And hey, when you're thinking about Sasuke's 1994, yeah, he has a Dome date on that, and it's one of the more famous Dome shows of all time on top of everything.
The first half of this match is led largely by Shinzaki and Sato, which I thought was a really unique pairing. I don't feel like we've seen a ton of that, and if we have, then I'm just not remembering it at this time. But
they were kind of kept apart, yeah.
Yeah, and the first half of this match is a lot of them together, and for the first half of this match, I thought, oh God, we're getting not a touring level Michinoku Pro match. We're getting an all-star level, you know, super Card of Honor, Blood Generation, Do Fixer style of match, because their chemistry was so good and their work was so crisp and so sharp. And I was such a huge fan of what those guys did with one another. And then from there, when it's not those guys in the ring, when they're not the primary focus, you see the match fall into comedy. You see a lot of Nanawa. You see it lose its edge. And by the end of it, I still think it's a match worth watching. I would go 3¾ on it, but it's a tale of two matches. And I think in a different context, if they really wanted to go all out, they had the attention of the dome for the bigger spots in this match, which in 1994 junior heavyweights, the sole men on an all women show, like they had the deck stacked against them and the high end work was so good, but they seemed to abandon that high end work about halfway through. And then it just became a match.
Yeah. I feel like that it became the Nanawa show, which I'm still charmed by Nanawa. I still think he's great at what he does with it, but it does have that ceiling on it. I mean, especially doing the Nanawa arm breaker comedy spot, like you can only really, when that happens, there's a cap of what you can achieve, right?
I do love that spot and I will pop for it always and until the end of time. But your larger point is there that yes, there's clearly a tone shift where it goes from Shinzaki and the man we would later know as Dick Togo going all out to, all right, we're going to hang out at the Tokyo Dome for a little bit.
Yeah. Hey, check that off your checklist there, Sasuke.
Yes, very much so. Anything else on that six man, or do you want to continue on the timeline?
Yeah, let's continue onwards.
Dave writes, November 28th, 1994 in The Observer, this is being written just before Survivor Series. Aside from the expected debut of Kensuke Shinzaki, although we don't know his name or gimmick, Shinzaki wrestles for Michinoku Pro, which is a Japanese lucha style promotion. He's very athletically talented, but who knows how much they'll let him show in a heel role. So we had talked about this, I think, two episodes ago, that there is very much a North American interest in Shinzaki, and things happen pretty quickly here. It's not a giant build and months of Dave writing, hey, you know, Shinzaki's being courted, he might leave Michinoku Pro, what does this mean for this indie promotion? It kind of goes from there's interest in Shinzaki to Shinzaki's coming in right after Survivor Series. And so we'll talk about that here momentarily. The other thing of note in the 1128 Observer is Dave writes in the New Japan section that a few matches were announced for the 1-4 Tokyo Dome show, an IWGP Junior Heavyweight title match of Norio Hanaga against the great Sasuke, as well as Hase and Muto versus the Steiners, and Shinya Hashimoto defending the IWGP title against Kensuke Sasaki, who was dropping the Power Warrior gimmick. They announced Koji Kanemoto, currently working indies in Florida, Nishimura doing indies throughout the U.S., and Hiroshi Yamamoto, working CWA in Europe, will work on a six-man tag as the new version of the Three Musketeers. It's widely rumored that Antonio Inoki will face Tiger Jeet Singh. Considering it's the Dome, it's a weak lineup, but the show has become tradition. And we will talk about that Sasuke match on the next episode.
Yeah, I don't think Kanemoto, Nishimura, and the man who would become Hiroshi Tenzan, I don't know if that Three Musketeer things lasted past the Dome in 95.
I certainly never heard them referred like as the new version of the Three Musketeers. Let me look at that card real quick just to see how that turned out. And again, we'll talk about the Sasuke match specifically, but yeah, that doesn't even end up happening. So you get Otani versus Samurai, Hanaga against Sasuke, a six-man tag that doesn't matter, and then it's Kanemoto versus Nagata in a singles match, Tenzan versus Nakanishi in a singles match, and then they do Tiger Jeet Singh and Tiger Jeet Singh Jr., who was Tiger Ali Singh. Okay, I was going to say, I didn't realize there was a junior there, but I did now, against Ohara and then Shiro Koshinaka, so that does not become an Inoki match. You get that Sting match that's a disaster. You get an Inoki match that's rated 2 stars on Cage Match against Gerard Godore.
The kickboxer. Yeah, Gerard Giroux. Yeah.
Okay, Drew, thank you. Letters blended together for me. I was lost for a second. And then Choshu and Yatsu versus Kimura and Goto, Chono and Sabu against Harada and Fujinami. That's a pretty fun match. Hawk Warrior versus Scott Norton, Inoki versus Sting, and then as Dave said, Muto and Hase versus the Steiners, and Hashimoto versus Kensuke Sasaki, which I have not seen in forever. I don't remember how that is. That is a fever dream of a show.
Yeah, we're gonna have a Gerard Gordeau talk later on in 95.
Oh God,
because he becomes.
Go ahead.
He becomes a figure with Naoya Ogawa.
Wow. Yeah, it's crazy
part of UFO.
When Chono versus Sabu, Chono and Sabu versus Junji Harada and Tatsumi Fujinami is not the weirdest thing on that show, you are in for trouble. Good Lord, what a weird show. What a long show.
I forgot that was a time that Super Strong Machine was unmasked and was working unmasked. I forgot that.
What's his name on this show?
Junji Harada.
Oh, that's God. I forgot that was who that was.
That's
so weird. Okay, yeah, no, I completely forgot. I was thinking
the show weirder because I think he's unmasked at that time.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't know who I was thinking of, but I was thinking that was a junior. But no, you're right. That is Super Strong Machine. That's so weird. I have no historical frame of reference for this show. I just know the main event and that the Sting stuff bombed. Wow, that is crazy. All right, little brief distraction there. On November 30th, 1994, I believe, and I had a hard time pinning this down, but I believe Hakushi versus Jobber Gary Scott is the Hakushi television debut. This is Wrestling Challenge 1994, Ted DiBiase and Gorilla Monsoon on the call. Mike, did you watch this brief squash match? And if you did, what do you think of it?
Oh, I absolutely watched this brief squash match at the Elks Lodge. Oh no, this wasn't Elk Lodge. This was Lowell.
Was Lowell. Yes, this is territory.
Yeah, it just was like a wild kind of fever dream. You do get a 1-2-3 Kid reference, which I think that's kind of a neat little nod. It's probably not intentional, but the match they had in that WWF tour, that was kind of neat. And I mean, all that happens is Hakushi does a front kick to Gary Scott and then tosses him over the top rope and planchas and wins by count out. And he looks cool as hell. You know, I mean, the commentary is awful, but I mean, that's 1994 WWF. What do you expect of it? I don't remember Shinja as a character, though, Case.
No, his second. I'm unfamiliar with the history there. This is such a historical blind spot for me, this era of the World Wrestling Federation. But I really enjoyed, because like the commentary is bad, but in an endearing way, because they're not sneering and mocking Shinzaki.
No.
This isn't mask off racist Jerry Lawler commentary. It's endearing in how bad it is because they are putting him over like a special attraction.
Yeah, I mean, it is basically, and I'm quoting here, going like, look at what this Oriental mystery man can do. Like, yes. That's what the commentary is.
Which, for as bad as that sounds, it could have been so much worse.
So much worse. I mean, that is a phrase that I don't think anyone has used since the year 2001 or in polite company much earlier, to be quite honest. But yeah, no. So he has this, but that's not before his final real farewell in Michinoku Pro, of course.
No, and again, just to note real quick, like you said, because I want to harp on this one more time, the finish is Shinzaki doing what in 2025 looks like a pretty standard tope to the floor. DiBiase says that reminds him of 1-2-3 Kid, and then that is the finish. As Gary Scott never gets up, Shinzaki goes back in the ring, and we have our victory from there, a bizarre count-out finish. I will note, as we go along into 1995, I did these notes almost a year ago now, so I don't remember exactly what's in there. I know we're going to cover Shinzaki versus Sabu on a Dennis Corluzzo show towards the end of 1995, because that has a million sliding doors. I know Between the Sheets covered a lot of that show on their F Sabu series, but I want to break that down from the Michinoku Pro perspective. We're going to do Shinzaki versus Sabu from the independent show that Corluzzo ran in 1995. Other than that, I don't remember what, if any, Hakushi stuff is going to be in our timeline. Like I said, this era of the WWF, complete blind spot. I know nothing about it. I've seen, you know, very little outside of the most pimp stuff there is. If there is a Hakushi match that you would like for us to cover that you think is relevant to the story of Michinoku Pro, or maybe just a great match that you would like for us to cover, drop a note in the Open the Voice Gate channel on the Voices of Wrestling Discord. I'll see if I can add it in, because I don't know. I don't know what he was doing in the WWF. It's a total blind spot for me, and we're not planning on covering a ton of it.
Yeah, in my kind of position, I I've never really felt the need or desire to go reassess New Generation WWF. It was before I became a wrestling fan, and did not, when I had access to that kind of stuff, see the need to go through WWF's misery. But if there's good stuff and folks want us to review and talk about it, absolutely drop it in the channel on Discord. Please
yeah,
do.
No, I'd be more than happy to talk about some of the good stuff there. So, Mike, you're right. Before Shinsuke would finally say goodbye to Michinoku Pro, we have two more shows to review: the 12/15/1994 television taping and the 12/17/1994 television taping. Let's obviously jump into 12/15 here at the start, and I give it back to you to take it away.
So we get most of this from a episode of Champ Forum that airs in January of 95. So this is an interesting three-show swing. They do not tape any at Osaka the next night, but they go Nagoya, Osaka, and Tokushima to end their year. Just attendances. Just want to read them off the bat just so folks can get kind of their head wrapped around it. Nagoya was 1685. They say it's a sellout of Osaka. I don't think they are running Bodymaker at that point. I think it's a place they were before. And then Tokushima, this 1536. So finishing the year strong. And on this, this tour is called Lucha from Lucha no Kuni 94. We do not get the opening match. And Case, it's probably for your benefit. Hanzo Nakajima defeats Nahiro Hoshikawa, but we do get from our friends at PWFG, Daisuke Ikeda versus Yuki Ishikawa as a shoot style comes to Michinoku Pro.
So you're telling me that I, alongside my good friend Mike Spears, start a Michinoku Pro retrospective podcast where we watch all of the Michinoku Pro footage that we have from a certain time period, and I have to sit through Daisuke Ikeda versus Yuki Ishikawa? That is not what I signed up for, Mike Spears.
Yeah, cards on the table. I think I can speak for both of us here. I have no interest in seeing a style that was dying at that time and died and has proceeded to die at death whenever it's been revived for the last 30 years. And I know Ikeda and Ishikawa are quite skilled at this, but this match is just not for me. Though my only like note of the match itself is it felt like that Ishikawa was kind of eating up Ikeda through it. But that was kind of it.
These guys have matches that I enjoy. They have a match in 2005 in Futen that is, I think, one of the more high-end shoot-style matches that there is. And Ikeda and Noah, I think, was an excellent wrestler at one point. But, oh my God, was this boring. I can't believe I had to watch this. I can't believe this ate up TV time on a series of shows where, there's a match on 12/17 that we got about 2 minutes of out of the 20 that actually happened. And I kind of wish we would have gotten more of that and way less of this.
No, absolutely. And then speaking of stuff that we're having to get through, join in progress, Yone Genjin versus Rukio Sachihoko. And I'm pretty confident to say that Rukio Sachihoko was Masato Yakushiji under mask.
And I think that's all that needs to be said. A giant, colossal waste of time. This Yone Genjin stuff continues to mess with me, and this was no different.
Yeah, the only thing of note was in the finish, Sachihoko, which if you're a Dragon Gate fan, you're going, oh, why is Sachihoko a thing? So Sachihoko are the statues on Nagoya Castle. They're seen as kind of the mythical creature that protects it. And whenever... And Sachihoko Boy and Sachihoko Machines were all referenced to that in Nagoya, and so was Rukio Sachihoko. But Rukio Sachihoko had him in a rocking horse gory special, and another Yone Genjin comes out to save the first for the DQ, and then there's a crowd brawl, and a mad scientist comes out and gets chains on both of them and drags them to the back.
It all sucked. I appreciate the enthusiasm you have in your voice as you're reading off your notes there, but not for me. This television taping, this episode of Champ Forum, off to a rough start.
Yeah, and it got me in a bad mood because I saw on Cage Match 6-man tag and it said not recommended yet, and I go, oh God, that must mean that this thing did not make tape, and we'll talk about it on the next half of Champ Forum because they decided to put this in the 6-man tag there. Do you just want to talk about this now as a part of the show since it was from the show?
Okay, let's do that. So this is Sato Shiryu and Terry Boy versus Grand Nanawa, Jinsei Shinzaki, and Super Delphin, commonly misattributed as a match that took place on December 17th. It aired on the December 17th television, but it took place on December 15th, the same show as Sasuke versus Taka Michinoku in the main event.
Yeah, and that becomes abundantly clear as you watch through the rest of this episode, or this half of Champ Form, because there's a Terry Boy clipped thing here. But yeah, same kind of finish that we got in Iwate with the double suplex and senton bomb on Nanawa. But this one, whereas I feel like you felt the other one in Iwate just kind of became a freewheeling mess that with like Nanawa kind of comedy through this, we got what I feel like was this kind of evolution of Kai and Tai, where like Sato at this point is really still gunning for Delphin after their two Apuestas matches in 93 and 94. And it felt kind of like a little bit of them falling back on that for this match, which will be important, all things considered, at when we move into 1995, that it feels like Sato is finally figuring out how to put down Super Delphin and kind of get control of this rivalry through this match.
Thought this was really, really enjoyable. I felt like this was the fully formed Kai and Tai experience that I had been looking for. Thought they were great as a unit. I thought the Sato Delphin stuff, like you said, was spectacular. And I thought Shinzaki, just to repeat our point from earlier, I thought Shinzaki was sort of the motor of this match. I thought for as good as Sato was, for as good as Terry Boy was, for as good as Delphin was, this was the Shinzaki show where he was able to go in. You know, at one point, you think about the difference a year makes, where at the end of 1993, he's the top heel. He has his rivalry with Sasuke. He's working an entertaining style, one that I wasn't expecting to like as much as I was, but this very slow plotting style that was beneficial to his character work. And then you see him
being Lucha Res Ric Flair. Yeah.
Yes. And now you see him 1 year later, and he's able to really turn up the engine and shift into a higher gear and work a style of match that, quite frankly, in 1993, he didn't get a lot of opportunities to, but I'm not sure that he would have been able to hang. But you see, just as it was with Toriumon and as it was with Dragon Gate, you spend so much time with these guys. You spend so much time traveling with them. The roster's small, so you're going to get entangled with everybody at some point. And sure enough, Shinzaki was here doing a classic Michinoku Pro style six man. And I thought he was the best guy in the match. And really, you know, when I think about 96 and 97, you know, it's not like he's in all of the pimped six mans. This is kind of a rarity for him to be the focal point of a six man tag that's as good as this one was.
Yeah, and it's interesting the dynamics that you kind of get coming out of this tour, where it is the outright Shinzaki farewell. On the 12/17 Tokushima show, they show Shinzaki actually doing like a merch line and everything. And you have him kind of being celebrated through this. And one of my takeaways in this match is, Case, I feel like, and I don't want to make like a grand statement here, I feel like in 1994, I enjoy Nanawa a little bit more than you.
And I don't dislike him, but I do think you enjoy him more than I do.
And I think that what we got to see in this match, but really when we talk about the main event of 12/17, we got to see a lot. I kind of like Nanawa and Delphin as kind of I feel like we missed out on a reality where this could be like a really fun, cranky old man comedy tag team working today. Mm-hmm. Like there was so much there with these two guys. Like you could tell that they had like going to the Armbreaker spot that we talked about at the Dome show. They understood comic timing. They understood the relationship of what the pairing should and would be. And of course, they, as we get deeper into the series with the alignments and dissolvement of Delphin Corps, they're still kind of affiliated when they're on the Sekigun side, but you don't necessarily have the propensity in a comedy match with them as faces to eat the shit that they do as heels in Delphin Corps. And I really wish we had like another decade of them doing these kind of tag matches. Because I feel like that's something that could have been like the Lucha-esque hallmark as much as Kunoshiro Kamen and Ebison are for Osaka Pro. Like, you see the starts of that kind of stuff here.
I think that's a very good point. I agree with all that. Another thing that I really enjoyed in this match is they do a big dive train at one point, and Shiryu is very hit and miss. I think you and I would both agree on that. You know, I think much in the sense that you've enjoyed Nanawa a little bit more than me. I've enjoyed Shiryu a little bit more than you, but there are times where he hasn't exactly lit the world on fire.
I'm now a believer, though. I feel like in 94.
We came around on Foley in 94. He does a dive on Delphin in this match.
The tope.
Oh my God. It's one of the most pretty things. It's one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen. And it's a great dive train with everybody involved to begin with. But Shiryu caps it off with that dive on Delphin. It's unbelievable.
So I should learn how to GIF and post some of these things, guys. But to describe it, at the end of the train, where you already have Sato doing his gorgeous tope con hello over the top ropes, you have Shiryu gain all the speed ever and bounce off the ropes and then go through the ropes and do the full rotation tope con hello, landing on Delphin and then quickly like getting back to his feet, like stumbling and getting like right to his feet. It's almost, to borrow a phrase about recent Dragon Gate, it's almost Fumita-esque.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I think that's a really good comp there.
Yeah, but just 4 stars on this trios match. And I'm at
4 stars as well, yes.
Go out of your way for this. It's on the first part of the 12-17 show. But then shifting back to what was the main event of 12-15 and the main event of that part of Champ Forum, you had that go into Great Sasuke versus Taka Michinoku. A match of what should be mentor and protege, though, torn apart by Super Delphin's machinations saying, hey, Taka, you should go heel and join Delphin Corps. Now they finally come head-to-head as singles wrestlers, and Taka trying to fight back and trying to prove that he is on the level of the ace of the company.
I've been talking about this match, I think, since our very first episode, since the very first time we saw Taka Michinoku, because I remember, and I've talked about this before, but on the old Voices of Wrestling forum, so we're going back now 10 or 11 years, my introduction to Michinoku Pro was our friend Alan posting a list of Michinoku Pro match recommendations with ditch links so you could download the matches and watch them, and he had all the descriptions. And one of the matches on that list, and I have the playlist if anybody wants it, I don't have the links to all the matches, but I have the matches in the descriptions, was Sasuke versus Taka. And I was floored by this match the first time that I saw it. It's the one that really made me a believer in the idea that Taka Michinoku is one of the 100 greatest wrestlers of all time. And I went back into my notes. Let me see if I can pull these up real quick to see what date I would have written these. It copied it over from a different folder. I don't have the date, but I'm talking about notes that were written 10 years ago, in which I write in all capital letters, if you are contemplating voting for Taka for greatest wrestler ever, go back and watch this match again, because Taka puts forth just an all-timer in this match. Very reminiscent, I think, of when Shingo Takagi first started getting pushed in Dragon Gate, and you have this, you know, established generation, Shima, Mochizuki, Susumu, whoever it may be. You know, you had the Torimon guys, and Shingo was the first Dragon Gate Trueborn, and Taka is sort of the first guy that we've seen step up to the plate against Sasuke specifically that didn't have a rich history in Universal. Now, granted, he was there, but nobody ever mentions a Taka Michinoku Universal Pro Wrestling match, a Universal Lucha Libre match. Taka is, for all intents and purposes, a product of the Michinoku Pro system. And the dynamic of him going against Sasuke in this match is a really special one, and one where Taka absolutely steps up to the plate. Do you know what wrestler, and this is not a rhetorical question, I'm going to give you nothing to guess off of, you'll have a million names to guess from. Do you know what wrestler Taka Michinoku reminded me of in this match? A proper heavyweight wrestler that Taka reminded me of in this match?
I'm just going to guess 1, 2, 3, kid.
Brock Lesnar. I felt like Taka Michinoku put forth the Lucha Wrestle Brock Lesnar performance in this match. Peak Brock. There's something about the way that Taka works when he's really on, and he was really on in this match, where you feel his presence constantly. Sasuke can be on the floor, and there's a chance that Taka's in the ring getting ready to do a big springboard. You can have Sasuke on one side of the ring. It can feel like Taka's ready to charge at him and do something at a moment's notice. You feel like the match could end at any moment. You feel like the match could have anything occur at any moment. Taka really reminded me of 2012 through 2014 Brock in this match. And coming from me, that's an incredibly high compliment.
You know, I felt like he was an absolute piranha in the best kind of ways in this match, where he gets picked apart a little bit early, but because as soon as he gets advantage, he decides that he's going to absolutely just tear into him. A mean double stomp from the table on the floor, and his ability to like, the thing that gets me about him at this point, I love his Spaceman plancha, where he just, it feels like that for a guy really of like his ability, he's not able to get as far as he jumps on this, but it felt like that he flew about 15 feet for his Spaceman, just plancha through it. And the fact that you have some selling based off of the explosion match and a passion kind of Sasuke of how he's going to kind of survive this, where he ends up winning by doing the Fire Thunder power bomb, followed up by a chicken wing where he keeps on the hold until Hanzo pulls him off and he tries to cut a promo, but Taka angrily responds and storms off. And you feel like, okay, you came out of this with, okay, Taka is almost there. Like you basically see Sasuke have to go to a certain depth where he just basically chokes the guy out in order to escape him in this. And the frustration from Taka coming out of it just has me on like the edge of my feet going like, all right, next time they get each other, I feel like that they're going to be able, that Taka is going to be able to beat him there. And it just was a really cool thing. And it makes sense at least in the format that they did, that you can't really have that angle as like, you want to have that angle separate from the Kaientai stuff. So you double up the Kaientai stuff on the next episode, but it does kind of, in a way, before I knew I was getting that 12-17, that match on 12-17, I was like, man, I like this match, but I really wanted to get Kaientai. Lo and behold, we would get that on the next half of that file.
I don't know if this is a hot take or not, but through the first 2 years of the existence of Michinoku Pro, this is, I think, the best singles match that the company had.
It's either that or the first Sato Delphin Apuesta.
Yeah, so I was just, that's what I was comparing it to. I was just looking at my spreadsheet that I've got here, and I have, I'm going to go in order of star rating here. Sasuke versus Delphin 724.93 at 3¾. Sato versus Delphin 3494 at 3¾. Sasuke versus Shinzaki 331.94 at 3¾. And then Sato versus Delphin 12.10.93 at 4¼. Mm-hmm. Sasuke versus Shinzaki 429.94 at 4. I would also put this at 4¼, and I would have it higher ranked than Sato versus Delphin from 12.10.93.
Oh man. I would have to think about that. I mean, it's now, I think I'm still Sato and Delphin.
I get that. Yeah. No argument from me. We don't need to, I'm not going to hang up on this call because you like that more. But this is, I mean, again, you think about all the stuff that we consume and all the matches where it's like, okay, I know I've seen this, but I don't remember anything specifically from it. And for over a decade now, this match has been stuck in my head with just how good Taka was here. And there were some spots that were burned into my brain that I remembered. There were some spots like him doing the double foot stomp off of the announce table, the timekeeper's table. I didn't remember that, but my God, was that exciting to see. It's just, this is really the beginning now. And I've hinted at this, and Taka has been one of my big talking points as we've gone along in these episodes of like, okay, he's good now, but just you wait. And also just you wait for how he's revered in the newsletters and the way that people speak about Taka in 94, 95, 96, 97. And this is really the start of it. It's no different than, I think, 9705, the Blood Generation versus M2K six-man, where Shingo squares off against then Dreamgate champion Mochizuki. And that is, for all intents and purposes, the start of Shingo's career. And the first, like, wait, who's this guy? What's he doing against Mochizuki? He has that type of performance. And Taka here, it's the same way.
Absolutely. And it's nice to see, like, as they get out of 95, we don't have everyone on the those days, on the these days, 10-man, completely online, but now I feel like we have another figure, like how Shiryu was earlier this year, kind of step into the fray, and it's a great note for Taka to end out 1994 on. Let's get back to 1217 at Tokushima. We get a lot of clip stuff here. I'm just going to run through it real quick. The Jensei Senzaki farewell, which we mentioned, was him at the merch area, and that leads into clips for three matches and one that's going to make Case very angry. The first one was Wilkins and Yone, and this time Wilkins and Yone fall off the balcony to get a count out here. Terry Boy versus Aja Gojahai, who is another Yakushiji kind of character, and Terry Boy wins the spinning toehold. And I feel like one of the, if Case could go into Gaora Studios and see the tape libraries and see what he can find, he is going to go find from 1217-1994 Kai and Tai, Sato and Shiryu versus the great Sasuke and Grand Hamada.
Yeah, I mean, what are we doing here, guys? We get like 2 minutes of this match that, as I look for the final runtime here, this match went 1740. So we get hardly any of it, but we do get Sato and Hamada having a chop battle. We do get some accidental friendly fire, and then we get a crazy dive train towards the end of this match with Sato killing Sasuke with a no-touch tope, only for Sasuke to come back and hit a big Asai moonsault. I mean, this was awesome from what we saw of it. I would like to know what the other 15 minutes looked like.
Odds are pretty great, I would say.
Yeah, I have no doubt from the clipping of this match that this is a pretty special one that has unfortunately just been lost in editing, in the editing room, which is a real bummer. And I guess we shouldn't bury the lead here. So Hamada comes in on the 12-16 show and Osaka wrestles Taka Michinoku. Of course, no footage of that. Why bother? You know, just 1994 Taka against 1994 Hamada. And then we get this. And then we'll see more of Hamada in 1995, sometimes as Hamada, sometimes as a character under a mask. And then 1996 is when he becomes full-time at Michinoku Pro. So still a little bit of ways, but this is, since the debut show, the first bit of Hamada that we've seen, and it's a welcome inclusion to the podcast.
Absolutely so, and especially as we move along, another figure of that match coming into fray here. So I would say by the end of 94 with him in Mexico, that's the end of the string for him at that point.
Yes.
So we're really coming to the point where he does make Michinoku his full-time home, but that's not now. What is now is the Jensei Senzaki farewell to Michinoku Pro. This was a mixed pairing of Delphin Corps. So you get the opposite sides from the tag league final, in that you have Taka Michinoku and Jensei Senzaki on one side versus Super Delphin and Grand Nanawa. Senzaki gets the win on the in the fall of a praying powerbomb and finally talks to finish out his this current tenure in Michinoku Pro, but it felt like that this was the match that had to end it for him, at least in this tenure. And I feel like that have to give credit to Sasuke here. This, I don't think you could have done a match to kind of blow off his run and finish it up after everything that he's done, unless there was another blood feud going on at this point. The one thing that made sense is to see kind of their farewell to this edition of Delphin Corps.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought this was so fun. It puts a bow on Shinzaki's time in Michinoku, at least for now, that I think is really interesting, because to reiterate my point from earlier, when we started this podcast, I never would have imagined that I enjoyed his work so much. And now as he leaves in 1995, I'm curious to see if Michinoku Pro suffers at all. And what you get here is really the final act of an era. We're moving into something else after this. We're moving into a more Kai and Tai focused promotion. We're moving into a different era of Delphin's career. We're obviously moving into a different era of Taka's career. Sasuke is not in this match, but Sasuke is going to be something else in 1995 and beyond than he was in 1994 and before. And Shinzaki is just this figure that looms large and cast a big shadow over Michinoku Pro. But along the way, I think he made a lot of guys better. I think he made Sasuke better. I think he made Terry Boy better. I think what we see of him in Delphin is super, super interesting. And this is a match that I think is not only one just from a sentimental point that is worth watching, but it's also a really, really good match.
Yeah, I was 3¾ on this.
As was I.
I thought that this rocked. You know what move that Shinzaki does so well that I wish would come back into style? And it makes sense why it has fallen out of style.
Can I guess? Because I have a note about a specific move that he does.
Okay, what is your guess?
Is it the press slam?
No, but that's a great one.
Because I like the way he does it different than a lot of guys, because he does it on the rebound of an Irish whip. So guys will be running at him and he's able to press slam them, which I always think is such a cool move.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is something that whoever the requisite beef wrestler in AEW for this month needs to be doing. But mm-hmm. The move I want to come back in style. You know what we don't have a whole lot anymore? Heavy, slow-looking enziguri counters. And Shinzaki does like a step-up one that I guess since the Shining Wizard was invented, that's kind of become one of those moves that supplanted the other, really, especially after Muto popularized it. But
yeah,
I miss like a enziguri that's not like the snap X-Pac, you know, which one, the Waltman style, where it feels like it's very snappy. This one felt like it was like a lumbering, oh, here you go, I'm stepping up to kick you in the head. And it absolutely rocked. I want to bring that back, and let's bring back the Irish whip press slam while we're at it, Case.
And I like that Nanawa did an airplane spin in this match. We could bring that back as well. This is really, I know we have wrestlers that listen to this, and if they've made it this far in the podcast, 12-17-94, Shinzaki and Taka versus Nanawa and Delphin. Give this match a watch. There's some stuff you could take from this.
Yeah, Taka and Shinzaki in another reality would have had a real fun tag league run in Michinoku Pro.
I tell you, and it's just... It's a larger problem in wrestling, and with Brian Danielson no longer being an active wrestler, it's only going to get worse. But just the presence and the pacing and the almost stalker-like vibe that Taka brings to some of these matches, there's no one bringing that. I think Shun is actually a similar comp, but Shun is of such different makeup that it's not the same energy. But Taka, you know, he's the smallest guy in a room full of small guys, and yet he reminds me of Brock Lesnar at certain points. And I think people should take heed of that and maybe go back and watch some old Taka Michinoku. I think wrestling might be better off that way.
Yeah, this episode, now that I'm kind of like looking at my notes and everything, Taka took a hell of a beating in Iwate. Like, he really got eaten up by Kai and Tai. Had the great match against Sasuke on 12-15, and then this tag match. This might be the first time on those days that if we awarded an episode MVP, as much as we would want to give it to Jinsei Senzaki, I think you have to say it's Taka Michinoku.
I'm with you. Look, again, that individual performance that he has in the Sasuke match, let alone the other things that he does in this episode, you will not hear an argument from me. I would certainly agree with that.
Yeah, and Delphin doing airplane spins, showing a little bit of heft considering his size was kind of a neat thing too. You know, to bring up that point. But as I mentioned, finish was a praying powerbomb on Nanawa. They do a big farewell to Shinzaki, and it feels like an actual kind of moment for like the promotion. I mean, you mentioned he was the specter that loomed large, especially in a promotion that has no real title belts. It felt like the biggest program in this promotion was the eventual Sasuke versus Shinzaki match. We saw how big it did for them in Oda, and it feels like that now, like as we are going to move into 1995 on the next episode of Those Days. You said it right. We're at the end of the era, and it's time to start a new one as we move into 1995.
I think we will feel a huge generational shift with our next episode. The next time you hear from Those Days, It will be Sato's revenge. We will be going back to the Tokyo Dome this time for New Japan Pro Wrestling. We will be dipping our toes into the pro wrestling Fujiwara Gumi waters, and then we will have two Michinoku Pro shows to review, the two that make tape in early 1995, including Sato versus Delphin in Osaka, Super Delphin's hometown.
Boy, I can't wait for that show, knowing what's coming up. It's real fitting that 94 ends the way it does, because 1995 is going to turn the promotion on its head. Case, anything else you want to add on this edition of Those Days before we get out of here?
I do not believe so.
Well, that will do it this time. As Case said, next time we're coming back with Sato's Revenge. And if you want to follow Those Days and our Open the Voice Gate show, you can do that on social media, both Blue Sky and Twitter, at Open Voice Gate. Case is on Twitter at underscore in your case. I'm at Fujiheya. As we talked about earlier on the show, the best place to kind of join in on the conversation and keep up with our comings and goings with Those Days and Open the Voice Gate is the Open the Voice Gate channel on the Voices of Wrestling Discord. We always make sure that whenever an episode of Those Days is released, that on that in that channel, as well as the show posting on voicesofwrestling.com, that's where we will have the match listings talking all about those and links to get you to go and see those as well. But there's also the Dragon Gate channel on the Voices of Wrestling Discord, the Misc Puro, which gets some Michinoku, modern Michinoku Pro mentions there, but that's all at the Voices of Wrestling Discord. And we'll be back with you next time to talk about 1995 Sato versus Delphin Renewed and a whole lot more. Take care, everyone.
My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines. And we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.